I think there's too many people in the United States who are hoping for a violent revolution in Cuba. I don't think there'd have to be a violent revolution. I think that...
To understand geopolitics, you must have the freedom to be honest.
The More Freedom Foundation podcast.
Hello, Rob. How have you been?
Not bad, Rory. How are things going with you?
Yeah, things are okay. Have you been working on much this week?
Yes, I am. I'm very pleased because I've finally been making some progress on a long-promised book that I've been writing. It's called American Empire, The First 100 Years. I really love Avoiding the British Empire, the last book that I wrote, but heard from a few people that it was a little bit too long and a little unclear. So what I'm writing now is just a decade-by-decade account of the U.S. empire, what it's been up to, what it's been doing. I would argue that the U.S. became the most powerful country in the world in the spring of 1917, when the British basically ran out of money to fight World War I, and the U.S. stepped in to keep them going. So I think I'm just writing. I'm actually finally making progress on the book, and it feels pretty good. Don't know when it'll be coming out. I'm hoping this fall, but progress is being made, and it feels good.
Do you think the book will be out before sanctions are lifted on Cuba?
Yes. I think the answer to that, unfortunately, is yes. I am kind of optimistic if Biden wins. That's a big if. Or some other Democrat, some other Democrat wins in 2024. I do have a hope that, especially if Florida goes redder, I have a...
They're sort of gerrymandering themselves, it seems, with Florida.
Yeah. But I have hopes that possibly there'd be some progress on the embargo. I don't think it'd be done away with entirely, but I think a Democratic president does have some levers that they could pull to make the U.S.-Cuban relationship a bit better. And yes, that is a great segue, Ray, because today we are talking about Cuba. Briefly, I think we should talk about Cuba and China, but I think I want to go deep on the reasons why Cuba and the United States have such historic problems, because that is, of course, the reason why China is able to have supposedly growing ties. And thankfully, because of this writing, it has been a variety of things. I actually have to be grateful to the Wall Street Journal for rising this alarm about Chinese involvement in Cuba, which has supposedly been stepping up recently, because that convinced me to finally go read a book on Cuba. I think I should actually pitch this because this is what much of the material that I'll be talking about today comes from. It is an American history Cuba, An American History by Ada Ferrer. I think it's a great book and definitely got me further up to speed on Cuba. So I was convinced to get further up to speed on Cuba. And then I was like, well, my book is going to need a Cuba chapter. It's a very happy set of affairs. So for the past week, I've been thinking about Cuba pretty hard and writing about Cuba pretty hard. So I'm excited to get into it, Rory.
So what part of Cuban history would you like to start from?
We should start at the beginning, but actually we should maybe start at the end and the most recent thing. It seems pretty clear to me that there are factions in Washington, D.C., working with the Wall Street Journal, trying to sabotage U.S. diplomacy with China. I'm not sure if we talked about it. We might have talked about this in the China episode. The Wall Street Journal has the actual term that the Wall Street Journal uses for these revelations that they have spoken to current and former U.S. officials as the basis of these recent stories. On June 8th, Wall Street Journal broke the news that the Chinese have a new spy facility in Cuba. The Biden administration actually pushed back against this rather hard, saying, actually, there's nothing new here. We've known about this spy station. It was established in 2019 on Trump's watch. We don't understand why you're making such a big deal about this. And we're irritated you're making a big deal about this because, of course, Blinken was Secretary of State. Anthony Blinken was just in China this past weekend, or actually it'll be 2 weekends ago when this episode airs.
Do you feel that helped smooth things over from when Xi Jinping got snubbed because of the balloon incident?
Well, that's the hope. And I was actually very happy to see that, the balloon incident was, I think we talked about this in a recent episode, but Blinken was going to China in furtherance of a November meeting between Xi Jinping and Biden, that it was nice and civil. And it was announced on a Friday that Xi Jinping would deign to meet with the Secretary of State, which is, not something in keeping with typical diplomatic protocol.
He should be meeting Biden, not one of his underlings.
Exactly. And then that was announced on a Friday. And then on Monday, Blinken canceled on him because of the balloon thing. So I was very pleased to see that Xi Jinping, in a very carefully formal and stiff and official looking meeting, did meet with Blinken, and in a context that made it clear that Blinken was a subsidiary or what have you. And that did happen, and I was happy to see that.
If they were working with China more, I feel the Cuban economy would be much better.
Oh, 100%.
Because if we see what happened historically when they threw their hat in the ring fully with the Soviet Union because America had a sort of fallen out with them in a very large way, it feels like the same sort of deal would have happened. They also then tried it with Venezuela, and everything went as bad as it could have with Venezuela. So it feels like replacing it with China would suggest Cuba would be doing wealthy if there was such a big close-knit community. But sadly, Cuba is not doing well at the moment.
No. Cuba, things went pretty well with Venezuela and Cuba.
They went well, and now Venezuela has crumbled.
Yes.
So it felt like every ally they found suddenly became incredibly unwell.
Yeah, and I think since 1992, Cubans have been very, very, very interested in a closer relationship with China. But China always knew that to do that would very heavily antagonize the United States, so they've steered clear. And to be clear, they still are largely steering clear. It's a question now. It's part of this give and take between China and the United States, the degree to which China will actually commit to this. The Chinese government has denied both of these Wall Street Journal stories. There was another one. So on June 8th, the Biden administration pushed back. We're recording this on June 20th, which is when the Wall Street Journal, again, speaking to current and former U.S. officials, whatever that means, now says there's going to be a military training facility on Cuba that involves the permanent stationing of Chinese troops. And this is a huge red line for the United States. This is something we'd be really, really angry about for all a whole range of historical reasons, paying absolutely no attention to the fact that Biden and Trump broke the stricture against U.S. troops on Taiwan for training purposes. So this is a tit for tat. This is if it's true. So this is news that literally broke 6 hours ago. As of recording, China's going to deny it. The Biden administration may or may not have pushback on this. But the timing is just extraordinary. The big news this morning was specific. This is the 20th of June when we're recording this. The big news this morning was that Xi Jinping deigned to meet with Blinken. Both of them said nice things about the meeting. There was nothing groundbreaking, but it was a good step forward. And the Wall Street Journal is putting out this story to kill the positive aspects of this meeting. Quite frankly, the timing is not coincidental in my mind. All good thinking people have contempt for the Wall Street Journal's opinion page. I think the Wall Street Journal has fantastic reporters, and any reporter given this story would run with it. So I'm not like saying pillorying the Wall Street Journal or what have you. I think they do excellent. The journalism side, Wall Street Journal is excellent. But it's very clear to me that current and former U.S. officials, former U.S. officials, that essentially, presumably, they work for Lockheed Martin or Northrop Grumman or some other think tank that takes a lot of money or university that takes a lot of money from one of those industries. So this is very clear attempts at sabotage for the Biden administration's efforts to improve relations. Probably all we need to say about that. That's sort of the reason why we're hearing so much about this China-Cuba stuff. And I think we should be a little bit suspicious of this news. However, both the Cuban interest in closer relations with China is very, very obvious, and especially considering the way that the Biden administration has been treating the Taiwan red line for China, it makes a lot of sense that China would be a lot more interested in the Cuba red line.
Would it not make absolute sense then for America to then get on with Cuba to, you know, stop Cuba trying to get on with other people?
Rory, I could not agree more. That would be the message of this episode.
Because it feels sort of like both ends are happy. Like, you know, if you're generally just someone that likes to start wars and get annoyed at people, it felt like you should really nip this Cuba thing in the bud and get on with them. And if you're a bit more of a, it'd be nice to help a neighbor that we used to get on very well with.
Yep.
You know, it feels like both sides should be happy with closer ties with Cuba.
Yeah. Well, the United States should want more. Yeah, exactly. It's a tremendous distraction. It's a tremendous vulnerability. And to be clear, it's not Cuba that's like, I mean, certainly there's a lot of rhetoric from Cuba talking about, oh, yeah, we don't want U.S. money. That's the dumped romantic partner trying to make it sound like.
Well, I think they're desperate. You know, they're desperately trying not to just be living off the dollars, from what I understand. And then they had two currencies, the Cuban peso and the Cuban convertible pesos.
I don't know anything about that, Murray. Is that something that's ongoing, or did that end?
It's ending. They brought about it recently, so it's one of the reasons why they're having a lot of economic issues, because they were trying to just not be so heavily reliant on the dollar. So they were one-to-one with the dollar, while Cuban pesos were, I think, about 25-to-1.
Oh, man, currencies. It is a rough thing. It is a rough thing. That, one of the great, great luxuries about living in the United States and Europe is that usually we don't have to think about our currency much. We don't even have to, usually don't have to even worry about inflation much. And the incredible difficulty of living in a place that is targeted by U.S. sanctions, it's like...
I heard something that like Venezuela's inflation was like 1,000,000%.
Gosh.
It was just something ridiculous I couldn't really comprehend. But yeah, so 10% doesn't seem too bad compared to that.
I mean, imagine living in a society or an economy where you just couldn't, you just did not know what anything cost from day to day. It sounds horrific to me. We're very lucky to live
yes.
where we do. I think we've got the preliminaries out of the way. I think it makes sense to go back to the beginning and talk about Cuban and U.S. relations. And I think there's just really fundamental misunderstandings here. Absolutely, U.S.-Cuban problems are about overly powerful Cuban refugees in Florida, for sure. But it's much deeper than that. There's just a really fundamental mismatch between the aspirations and expectations of these two countries that has been going on, frankly, for centuries. Cuba became formally independent from Spain in 1898. But I think that the period really from the end of the U.S. Revolutionary War up until Fidel Castro's revolution in 1959 can fairly be characterized as a kind of U.S. empire in Cuba. Towards the beginning of that, obviously nowhere near as powerful, you know, in the early 1800s, the United States in some ways was less economically significant than Cuba. But by the end, by the middle, and certainly by the end of the 19th century, the economic penetration of Cuba by the United States was already massive and growing. This book, which I highly recommend, again, Edda Ferrer, she talks about how in the 1850s, the U.S. vice president was sworn in Cuba. And she makes much of that. But it's just a sign of just how close the relationship was. Every founding father, not every founding father, but and most U.S. politicians assumed that Cuba was a natural, eventual, inevitable part of the United States of America. That is just the baseline assumption of almost every 19th century U.S. politician. She talks about how Franklin Pierce came to power explicitly promising that we'd take Cuba. It just didn't work out. Honestly, the main reason the United States didn't invade and annex Cuba was because Northern politicians in the run-up to the Civil War didn't want it because they didn't want another slave state. And that's a really key thing to remember. And very strangely, in the Spanish-American War, we didn't take Cuba because we sort of argued ourselves out of it in kind of a strange way. And the aftermath of the Spanish-American War, we took Puerto Rico, we took Guam, and we took the Philippines as official U.S. territory. The problem was that part of the way we convinced ourselves to fight against the Spanish was because the Spanish were so mercilessly crushing a heroic Cuban movement for independence. So it's this very strange thing, whereas certainly in the 1890s, most Americans wanted Cuba to be part of the United States, but to motivate the public that might not have necessarily wanted a war, to get to a war, we had to talk about the heroic Cuban independence movement. So weirdly, even though we absolutely screwed that Cuban independence movement at every level, we couldn't go that extra step and annex it the way that we had annexed the Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines during the and the aftermath of the exact same war. But also part of the reason we didn't annex it is because I think the judgment is we just didn't have to, frankly, because we were already so intertwined and so in control of that place. And I think that's that fundamental misunderstanding. Reading about the Cuban Missile Crisis or just the before the crisis, the reactions to Castro's revolution is like, they're so ungrateful. How, you know, we liberated them from Spain. They're so ungrateful. We you know, we given them privileged access to the U.S. market. The U.S. purchased Cuban sugar, massive amounts of Cuban sugar on preferential terms, you know, for the first half of the 20th century. You know, we've done so much for them. How dare they betray us like this? And that, I think, is just fundamentally missing the extent to which the United States was influential in Cuba, not just since 1898 and taking, you know, kicking the Spanish out of Cuba, but for decades before that.
But didn't they then buy up large quantity of their farms after? Wasn't there like a sugar bubble before World War One, and Cuba kind of thought, oh, this is going to be the normal price for sugar, but it only lasted a year. So when a lot of those farmers collapsed, America just says, we'll buy them all. So in a literal sense, America did physically own a lot of Cuba.
Even before that. But yes, absolutely. Like the sugar booms and busts.
That was the final nail.
That was definitely a huge part of it. Like the sugar booms and busts, this, that, the other thing. So yeah, exactly. So there was this key thing that we're buying all your sugar. But even by the end of the U.S. occupation, because there was a U.S. occupation from 1898 to like 1902 or 1903 or something like that.
Not just Guantanamo?
Well, Guantanamo, well, we took in 1898 and have never left. But there was a, Guantanamo is the naval base where we are still.
Also, you'll hear people use the term Gitmo, which confused me for a long time.
Yeah, which is a tremendously strategically important naval base, but also has become more famous as a completely unjust extrajudicial holding pen for U.S. enemies.
That America pays rent for and Cuba never cashes the checks, famously.
I think it's worth pointing out that there's a string of political problems. Before Spain was kicked out, it was more in the context of anti-slavery revolts because Cuba had slavery until the 1870s, I believe. Anti-slave revolts, revolts against Spain, all mixed up together in weird mixes that can sometimes be contradictory. Like you've got a lot of rich white Cubans who don't like Spain so much, but also really like having slaves. So like aren't super excited about big armed groups of slaves fighting against Spain. So these sort of tensions are ongoing and just abortive revolution after abortive revolution. And this might be a trifle unfair, but I honestly don't think it is. In 1895, a new Cuban revolution launched, and by 1898, it looked like it was going to win. So you can argue that actually the U.S. jumped in and kicked out the Spanish so that the Cuban independence movement couldn't kick out the Spanish. So essentially went in to stop that revolution, and functionally that's what they did. This revolution was famously, you know, Afro-Cubans were heavily represented in that revolution. The U.S. wasn't a slave state anymore in 1898, but we were a Jim Crow state. So all those generals...
Many Americans have moved to Cuba so they could continue being slave owners?
Absolutely. That definitely happened. Folks, in 1865, the Confederacy loses. Ada Ferrer again. tracks a number of families who, slave-owning families who moved to Cuba to preserve their lifestyle. It didn't last long, though, because of exactly this ferment that I'm talking about. Because there was, certainly from the mid-1800s up until 1898, there was this constant ferment, constant back and forth, 10 years war of revolution. Then there was a shorter war, and then there was probably ongoing guerrilla fighting throughout the whole period. And by the 1870s, the Spanish acknowledged that slavery was no longer viable. And they did emancipate, they did abolish slavery in a series of steps that, I won't get into the complexity of. Briefly, yes, there were Confederate families who moved down to keep owning slaves in the South, and in some cases brought their slaves with them. But within a decade or two decades at the longest, they sort of realized they couldn't do that there either, and most of them moved back to the United States. But that was absolutely a factor. Growing U.S. influence, even while the Spanish were still nominally in charge, because the Spanish Empire was falling apart, didn't necessarily have so much money. U.S. plantation owners it was just a regular part of U.S. investment even before independence to buy up stuff. In 1898, famously, the revolution was besieging Santiago. Famously, the revolution, the Cuban Revolution, before the Americans got there, was besieging the city of Santiago. Americans came in, took it, and refused to let the Cuban Revolutionary Army into Santiago. And this became a theme throughout a 4 or 5 year occupation. The United States said, oh, of course, well, we've committed. And actually, in the authorization of the U.S. war against Spain or intervention in Cuba, there's actually something called the Teller Amendment that said, we are forbidden from annexing. So according to U.S. law, folks who wanted to annex Cuba were not allowed to. But there was a 5 year occupation where there was tremendous reorganization of the laws and the way things worked in Cuba. There was a lot of landowning out in eastern Cuba that was still done in like a interesting mix of approach to land that was communal ownership in some degrees, this and the other thing.
Or you could see it like the commons, like feudalism.
To some degree, I don't have detailed knowledge of this, but yeah, I think that analogous to that, the U.S. Sorted that out in a sense where, you know, all kinds of peasants, Afro-Cubans, folks who had had title to that land lost title to that land, and somehow by 1902 it was all mostly owned by Americans. So there's this great, you know, we gave you the revolution, we bought all your sugar. Like, it's like, well, actually, we invaded to stop the revolution from reaching complete success. And we mostly were giving that sugar benefit to affluent citizens of the United States who owned Cuban land. Also, there was, I think by the end of, I might be confusing this, but it's fascinating that there, and that just how similar they were. There was a Cuban government that was established after independence while there was a U.S. occupation. And I believe it had to just resign because they knew the U.S. wouldn't accept it. So the U.S. maintained a pretty strong veto of who would actually be in power in Cuba. Famously, this did end in the 1930s, but in the initial Cuban constitution, before we would leave, we forced the Cubans to include what is known as the Platt Amendment. Platt, not a very Spanish, not a very Cuban name, Platt.
That's not, no.
The Platt Amendment to the Cuban constitution that explicitly provided for U.S. military intervention if things got unstable in the judgment of the United States. This was an actual part of the Cuban Constitution from 1902 or wherever it was up until the 1930s. And repeatedly between 1902 and 1959, you had revolutions or revolutions at the ballot box. You had just over and over and over again, you had loathed dictatorial figures that were turfed out by the Cuban public, whether it was at the ballot box or through outright protest. You know, everyone, even in the United States, everyone was like, oh, these people are miserable. They're terrible. And then the new guys would come in with all of this, you know, promise and revolutionary fervor behind them. Even Batista apparently had some, who was the famous dictator who made things so bad that the Castro regime is still riding on the coattails of how bad that guy was. Even he like had some initial positive things initially, but any person who came into power in Cuba in that period after independence up until Castro would inevitably have to make so many accommodations to U.S. interest, U.S. land interest, U.S. foreign policy, that they became useless and completely hated by the
Cuban population.
Yeah. And I see a real affinity between that same process of this really consistent Cuban elite from the 1700s until 1960 or thereabouts, that would constantly be working with either the Spanish authorities or the American authorities to make certain that they didn't lose their privileges and that the privileges of the outside hegemon, first the Spanish, then the United States, were not impacted. So I think it's really like reading this book, you know, diving in on this, it really is consistent with me to like looking at what the United States was up to in Cuba from the founding of the United States up until the early 1960s as a pretty straightforward version of U.S. empire. And that explains so much more about the just strangeness of U.S.-Cuban relations than anything else I've been exposed to before.
Am I right in the fact that it was America that fully pushed Cuba into communism? Because apparently Fidel Castro was hiding his true intentions, and they kind of ran as a sort of faux socialist-y kind of thing until the Cuban Missile Crisis, and only then did they confirm, yes, we're as full communist as the Soviets.
I think it was the Bay of Pigs. I think it was. So it's important to remember that the United States invaded Cuba in 1961. This was
Unfield.
You know, some argue that John F. Kennedy may have been killed because of his lack of support for this Bay of Pigs CIA program. I don't know if I'd go that far, but it is something that folks...
Well, there's a theory on every... Oh, well, there's a multitude of reasons why Kennedy was killed.
Yes, there are infinite theories. And who knows, maybe the Warren Commission had it right. That's definitely not a pack of worms I want to unpack today. Or ever, frankly. Castro, I think that's a really huge historical question. I would say that Ada Ferrer, the book maybe comes down more on the side of like Castro always had fairly strong socialist or communist leanings, but was very careful to
not fully expose them.
Yeah. But I think that's less interesting to me than just that dynamic of just how bad the dynamic between Cuba and the United States was leading up to Castro. And I think Castro was, my read on it, and this is completely wrong, and I have really read a single book on Cuban history at this point, so please ignore me, but my sense is that he was, you know, communist all the time or what have you. But I don't find that choice to be at all surprising when you consider just how bad the relationship between Cuba and the United States was. And it is... I think it's unfair to pin this on Cuban refugees in the United States because they really do come from all walks of life. But certainly the wealthier initial wave of Cuban refugees, the folks who left like the second Castro came into power and, you know, managed to get a fair amount of their money out with them, you know, are descendants of a elite in Cuba that has been against Cuba from the start. This is a fact about Cuba and Puerto Rico that is tremendously disappointing. The Spanish Empire fell apart largely as a result of Napoleon's invasion of Spain in the early 19th century.
I've also just heard a lack of modernization, kind of an obsession with the Roman Empire and never really moving beyond that.
That was certainly the case for a lot of the 1500s, 1600s, what have you. But in the 1700s, my understanding is that under the Bourbons, a new Spanish dynasty, once the Habsburgs were out, in the late 1700s, actually the Spanish Empire did a lot to reform, and but it was too late, I think. So I think what you talked about was absolutely the case for certainly the 1600s and most of the 1700s, but the Bourbons came in, and towards the end of the 1700s, there was massive reforms, massive attempts to make the Spanish Empire work better, but it was sort of falling apart. And I mean, to be fair, it took a lot longer for most of the South American countries to win their independence than it took the United States. It was a pretty fraught, difficult thing. But broadly, most of the South America became independent by, like, say, 1830 or thereabouts. Over that long process of fighting, most of those countries had to concede emancipation of the slaves. The reason that Cuba and Puerto Rico did not join that rampage towards independence was because the white Cuban and Puerto Rican elites wanted to hold on to their slaves. And that is not, you know, that is not instantly build, you know, that historical fact does not build affinity for me. When this is maybe more the case in Puerto Rico.
It's hard to say we don't like this guy because we miss our slaves.
Yes. Yeah, it's sort of that, like, and maybe this is more in my analysis of Puerto Rico, where there really are families there who are like, damn it, why isn't the U.S. doing more for us? And they're really like the people who, like, kept Puerto Rico not independent, you know, descendants of the people who kept Puerto Rico not independent to hold on to their slaves. But so, like, there was always that upper crust, and that sort of upper crust from the 1810s to the 1960s, I think, has really been Cuba's problem. And underneath that, you had tremendous diversity. And again, like, the Cuban refugees in the United States came from all socioeconomic classes. All socioeconomic classes have very good reasons to hate Castro. But generally, I do have a baseline lack of sympathy for people who are like, it was so great before Castro, because it was this, you know, this group of slavers that had to give up on slavery in the 1870s, but then, you know, decided that their success and their profit was to be found in catering to the United States. And it was that elite, that general approach that has made the history of Cuba so fraught and so difficult.
Because I see a bizarre parallel with what's happening now, where a lot of Cuba will have a power cut, but the parts that are catering to American tourists still have their lights on.
Yeah, it's very grim. It's because, and this has its origins in the 1990s when
Soviet Union collapsed.
Yeah, and simply stopped subsidizing Cuba. And everyone expected Cuba to fall apart. And this is one of a succession of moments where you're just, like, blown away by the commitment and continuity of Castro's revolution. Because I was reading this book, there's something like 70% of Cuban purchasing power evaporated. It's just, and I think part of that is definitely the survival of Cuba definitely has something to do with Venezuela, definitely has something to do with the authoritarian power and nastiness of the Castro regime. But I also, it just really, really fundamentally has to do with how poorly served Cubans were by Cuban elites in alliance with the United States for 150 years prior to the Castro Revolution. And I think that tremendous, largely justified resentment has given tremendous energy to the Castro revolt. But as you were saying, just that incredible sad irony of it is that one of the ways, the strategies they devised to survive the 1990s was to dramatically step up primarily European and Latin American tourism, and to get the dollars primarily that they desperately needed. And they didn't just have the hotels that had power while the rest of the city didn't. They had specific stores with goods that,
yes,
Cubans...
I've heard the thing you keep hearing is the country where taxi drivers get paid more than doctors.
Yes.
Because doctors is a government job, so you get paid pesos, which no other country wants.
Yep.
But the taxi drivers get paid in dollars, so they get to go to the dollar store, and it's, you know, the prices stay as they are, and the shelves are always stocked, while doctors have to go to the normal store where it's not always a fair price or even there.
So yeah, just tremendously grim, and And yeah, and that is where Cuba is. That is where we keep Cuba as of today. There was one thing that I just found out about for the first time, which just kind of blew my mind. Just talking about the amount of energy that just this revolution had. In the 1970s, Cuba had a full, like, expeditionary army in Africa.
Yeah, they were doing all sorts.
And it did some terrible stuff, shoring up the Derg, which was a really nasty regime in Ethiopia. But they did some really, I'd always known, oh yeah, the Cubans were in Angola or whatnot. And maybe I'm being led astray by Ada Ferrer, but I don't think so. I did some further research into it. Basically, the Cuban expedition to Angola strikes me as like the most positive expeditionary military movement I've seen since World War II. Like, it's up there with D-Day. Like, it is just extraordinary. So essentially, South Africa, this is something else I didn't appreciate. Perhaps, you know, as an American, I am really, really leery of looking into our decades of support for apartheid South Africa. But South Africa...
And your apartheid at home as well.
Well, yeah, I'm not a big fan of it. And it's not fun talking. Well, I mean, but in the U.S. now, we love talking about Jim Crow and how much further we've come or what have you. But even as those civil rights things were progressing in the United States was a firm supporter up through the Reagan administration of... an evil white supremacist government in South Africa. What I had not fully recognized is that they also had control of Namibia, which was called Southwest Africa or something at that point, up until the 1990s. And in the 1970s, after a leftist group had sort of taken power after the Portuguese left Angola, they invaded Angola. And most assumed, and the United States was quite content, to allow the South Africans to also take another African country to impose their gross white supremacist ideology. And this is in the 1970s, until Castro stopped them with an expeditionary force from Cuba. It's just stunning to me that this country...
It is incredible.
Yeah, that this country of 11 million, apparently upwards of 500,000 Cubans over a 10-15-year period, spent some time in Angola... fighting a long-term war against South Africa and its proxies. And at the end of this war, which included apparently the large, I think it's the Quito Canavale or something is the battle, which was seen as the most intense battle in Africa since World War II. At the end of that battle, South Africa had to go to the negotiating table where they not only gave up their aspirations in Angola, actually gave up Namibia, which they'd held since World War I. And then 2 or 3 years later, the apartheid regime fell entirely. And I was like, that is a just heroic, amazing thing that the Cubans did. And the Cuban regime is gross and anti-freedom, and I would love it if it fell very shortly. But just the Angola experience is just a testimony to the energy and power unleashed by the level of anti-imperial resentment that the United States had managed to build in Cuba. And I think that's absolutely fascinating. And I didn't really appreciate it. So my analysis, one of the things that I want to say in this book, American Empire, the First 100 Years, one of the things I want to point out that I think is clever anyway, is that I kind of think the Cold War ended in the 1950s. Like, I think that the Soviet Union really ran out of gas. They had proven themselves in their invasion of Hungary, to be contrasted with the U.S.'s very positive anti-imperial intervention in the Suez Crisis in the same year. The Soviets had sort of shown that they really weren't that anti-imperial. They were actually just their own...
imperialism.
Yeah, just a new version of the old evils. And really everything thereafter was mostly U.S. mistakes, somehow keeping this going. And yeah, one of the greatest mistakes was continuing to antagonize Cuba in the worst ways. While I do think that Castro was always kind of communist, there's no question that we played into his hands and we created situations with the Bay of Pigs invasion, with the Cuban Missile Crisis, that
which you could also call the Turkish Missile Crisis.
Indeed.
Because it sort of puts all the onus on Cuba when it feels very reactionary on their behalf.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think, and that's part of the way that I introduced it, is that Fidel Castro and Nikita Khrushchev didn't really understand the world they were living in. They assumed that all the PR was true, that we really lived in this world of two competing blocs. And now that this communist country in the Western Hemisphere had dropped into the Soviet Union's lap, then well, you know, there's nuclear weapons they were in West Germany, I assume, right? But they were definitely in Turkey. So now that we finally, you know, there are all these places in the Soviet Union that have nuclear missiles. Now that there's finally a communist one, we're in this competition of superpowers. So it's only fair that we get to do that. And the United States was like, no, we will end the world. Like we would, that was literally the Kennedy administration. That was what the Cuban Missile Crisis was. It was like the United States simply announced that we would end humanity if the Soviet Union treated us like an equal. And the Soviet Union had to back down to Fidel Castro's immense rage. I hadn't really appreciated the extent to which, now to be clear, the Soviets did massively subsidize the Cubans.
Oh, yeah.
But expedition to Angola, Ethiopia, etc., would not have been possible without Soviet support. But like the Cuban, there's an interesting passage in this book where actually Henry Kissinger concedes after having seen like declassified stuff. He's like, yeah, we'd always sort of assumed that like the Cubans were like these tools of the Soviets, but actually looking into it, like, yeah, the Cubans were just kind of doing their own thing with their own foreign policy.
Well, it's seen as sort of before when they got totally in bed with the Soviets, it was, you know, not the best people were in charge. It was generally friends and people that were mostly trusted instead of the most skilled. And then the Soviets seemed to give them a lot more technological advancement and teach them how to run factories and stuff. But I think they did, once they got going and got taught how to do things right, were able to function on their own. But yes, they weren't necessarily a Soviet Union. They were their own unique thing.
Yeah, their own unique thing. And I think they had a vigor and a revolutionary fervor that made the Cold War look a lot more active than it actually was by the 70s and 80s. In the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Aided again, of course, by tremendous U.S. mistakes in Vietnam and other places. But it's a really fascinating country that
Have you ever been there?
I've not. I've had many friends who've gone. But it is, I suppose, to bring it back to the concern we started with, the presence of China. Have you ever been there?
No, sadly not. I'm just interested in the cars. I think might be a good symbol of Cuba, which is they look like American cars that have been filled with, I think, Isopon over the years. So there's very little metal left, and they all have horrible Soviet diesel engines. So I think that might be it. The fact that they're still going could show the Cuban spirit to never give up and to continue in a revolutionary manner.
it's deeply, deeply impressive. And I was reflecting, reading this book, it's the only communist countries that are left. I suppose Venezuela is an exception, are those that have had the worst experiences of imperialism. It's China, Korea, which both had horrific experiences at the hands of the Japanese. It is Vietnam, had to deal with both the French and the United States, and Algeria, and Cuba. To hold on to a communist revolution at this point in the 21st century, in the face of the loss of your great sponsor, the loss of really any public sympathy for your cause anywhere else in the world, it takes a truly, truly nasty imperial experience. And I think that the Cubans really had that. And we don't necessarily acknowledge that in the United States.
And in the face of the Helms-Burton Act, which might be one of the most devastating things to happen to Cuba.
I hadn't read about that in much of this. That's in 1996 or something along those lines. And it's just a tightening up.
I think it's that thing we'd spoke about in the sanctions episode, which is companies that deal with it then can't deal with America, even if they're not American companies.
Yes. So that was a different era. So there's actually been a surprising amount of pushback So in the 1990s, Europe and other countries pushed back against U.S. secondary sanctions a lot more than they did in the post-9/11 era. So the Helms-Burton Act, I think, had a lot of difficulty establishing those secondary sanctions to the extent where I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's quite normal for, and has been for decades, for Europeans to go to Cuba. I think that's a...
Oh, yeah, it seems to be easy enough, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's been...
I've heard about people going, and you can't get Cuban cigars here and stuff.
Yeah, and I think that's been a tremendous support. And if the Helms-Burton Act was a successful example of secondary sanctions on the scale of what we've been able to do to Iran or Syria, then I don't think Europeans would be able to go to Cuba. But
it's still a massive roadblock. It's definitely not a good thing for Cuba.
Yeah, and I think in 1996, when Clinton enacted this, people were like, we'd already been waiting for Cuba to fall for 5 years, right? Like, you know, the Soviets are gone, and the Cubans are just the Soviet patsies. I think they've now proved, I think, quite comprehensively that they were not Soviet patsies. They really, really legitimately do not like us for some pretty good reasons. But again, like the Iranians, they are not...
They have been trying to get along with you, but America doesn't want to have it.
Exactly. Just like the Iranians. You know, the Iranians have been trying to get U.S. oil companies in there since the 90s. The Cubans since the 90s have been open to some kind of opening. And the great tragedy, the real heartbreak of Cuban relations is that Obama gave it to him.
He definitely got the ball rolling. He didn't do a huge amount, but a very small amount is considered a huge amount when it's American-Cuban relations.
Yeah, and crucially, Obama can't give Cuba everything because it's a congressional thing, the Helms-Burton Act, which you pointed towards, other congressional mandates. Obama, as president, attempted to use his sort of bully pulpit and, you know, to pull the levers that he could as a president to improve the relationship between the United States and Cuba. And then Donald Trump came into office, helped in part by a miraculous win in Florida, instantly crushed all of the positive motion that Obama had made, which was just tremendously depressing. Obama took Cuba off of the state sponsor of terror list, which is not something, a place where they belonged, in 2015. And then, as he was leaving office, Trump put them back on the list of state sponsors of terrorism, which Biden has utterly inexplicably failed to take them off again.
Because you could at least argue when they're doing their Angola thing that, oh, this is terrorism, blah, blah. But they're not doing anything now apart from alleged Chinese collaboration.
Yeah, I think they still send a lot of doctors to a lot of places.
Well, I heard that's one of the reasons they're doing badly at the moment is that was a great way of making money. But because of COVID, everything had to come home.
Oh, wow.
So apparently, it's one of these things. I don't know how true it is. Apparently, they've all these incredible cures, and medicine was definitely a big part of their economy. But bizarrely, you'd think COVID would help your economy, which, you know, it did places like Ireland, which has a large pharmaceutical sector, but not Cuba. And then everything went back. So it's massively dependent on imports as well. What worries me about what you've talked about, the secret Chinese bases, is America has a bad history of, if something has no evidence, can then be used as more evidence?
Yeah.
Because I remember these, do you remember the secret subs during the Cold War?
No.
There was this idea that the Soviets had secret subs, and they were so secret, the reason no one could find them is because they were so far advanced. So America then would have to spend loads more money, but there never were any. So the fact that you never find anything is a great evidence and a great way of pushing more money in that direction. And I worry that, oh, we haven't found these secret Chinese bases because they're so advanced. So we're going to have to do even more sanctions and more horrible things. Oh, so the no evidence is evidence always scares me.
Well, the another classic example is the missile gap. I think it was Kennedy, or maybe it was some other mid-century president who came to power being like, there's a missile gap. The Soviets have so many more missiles. And then we got like the actual records after the end of the Cold War, and they didn't reach parity with the United States until at the oil boom of the 1970s. And they just never had those missiles. Saddam Hussein never had weapons of mass destruction.
That's because they're still so well hidden, we haven't found them.
That's true. That's true. Assad must have, or something like that. that's a very real concern. And it's also a complete own goal. It's a complete, if the United States had continued with Obama's opening, and we didn't, you know, we wouldn't even have had to have completely lifted the embargo, just like really basic stuff. We could do some really small stuff and have enough to hold over Cuba that they'd never even toy with the idea of getting closer to China.
Well, an obvious thing is the economies of geography, which is generally the closer you are to other countries, the more you're going to trade. And you can essentially swim from Cuba to America.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
sadly a lot of people have done, because there's that strange law where if you touch American sand, you're an American citizen. Is that it?
So that's a 1990s thing. Before the 1990s, before Clinton, Cubans just had, no matter how you got here, no matter when you got here, if we find you, if we pick you up, the Coast Guard picks you up 5 miles off the Cuban shore, you get a fast track to residency in the United States. It was a Clinton-era limitation because obviously during the 1990s, things got dramatically worse in Cuba. So a lot more people were leaving. So that is a Clinton thing. Introduced if the Coast Guard picks you up, it'll take you back to Cuba, the U.S. Coast Guard. If you do actually hit U.S. soil, you get to stay there. And interestingly, by that point, even the Cuban Americans, there was this famous Mariel boat lift in the 1980s, and I've already forgotten the details of.
Fidel Castro flooded America with its undesirables, as he called them?
That's the most famous example of that. Ada Ferrer makes the case that was blown out of proportion, but no question, that was certainly the way that it was portrayed. It was much more Afro-Cuban than earlier versions. So even by the 90s, with the memory of the 1980s Mariel boat lift. Have you ever seen the movie Scarface?
I haven't, I'm afraid.
I think, Al Pacino plays a Cuban-American gangster, and I think the Mariel boat lift features heavily in the opening scenes, if I recall correctly.
It also features in a game called Tropico 3, which is essentially Cuba the game. And and one of the things you can unlock, it just sounds horrible the way they describe it, is a trip to Miami, where basically anyone that's you don't need anymore, don't want, you can just get rid of them and send them off to America. I thought that was quite distasteful.
That is quite something. But the point I was making, that by the 1990s, even the Cubans were, the famously anti-Castro Cuban refugees were okay with limitations on the kinds of Cubans that Castro was sending at that point, which is another thing that is, you know, does not fill one with deep respect for Cuban-American political types.
So is there any chance of optimism in the next coming years?
I would say so, because it's just so, just reading about it, it's just like, this is the dumbest thing imaginable. Like it's like we're trying to build our own Taiwan, really.
When you were talking about Iran, there's the whole domino effect of how it affects Saudi Arabia and Israel, which you just don't have here.
Yeah, there's no reason. There's not a reason in God's green earth. It's just, and it's interesting because Obama, despite rhetoric and way he's still looked upon by a lot of people, was not a transformational president in any way, but he's becoming, and I think he's becoming more and more critiqued for what a sort of establishment, you know, kind of Reaganite he was. But in the case of Cuba, it was just, you know, it was just so blindingly obvious that this was a silly thing that we were maintaining here. And it really is, when I say we're building a new Taiwan, we're building a new Taiwan from the Chinese perspective.
But it's also how unpopular this is worldwide. The UN quite often votes against this, and it's 99% in favor of abolishing these sanctions.
Yeah, it's
America and Israel that vote for them.
And it's 70% of the 60 or 70% of the U.S. public would like to be able to buy Cuban cigars and go to Cuba on vacation. It's not great, you know.
It's not just yourself.
I would love to do both of those things. But it is a absurdity that is
seems
in
like
this
very low hanging fruit, but yet it's still kept.
Yet it
away.
Persists. The Biden's cowardice on this is really inexplicable. I think he must think that he can still win Florida or something, because it's just, yeah, the fact, I think we've talked about this before in the China episode, the Mike Pompeo, Trump Secretary of State, last ditch, we're going to do these things because Biden's going to have to instantly reverse it.
Put one of those things, sugar in the petrol tank.
Yeah, one of those things was adding Cuba to the terror list in 2021. And I, you know, the Republicans assumed that Biden would instantly take him off, as he did with the Houthis, which was a very good thing, actors in Yemen. And he didn't. They're still on the terror list, which is just mind blowing. And I think even that, if we would just take them off the terror list, I think, you know, the Cubans would get a lot less receptive to Chinese infiltration or what have you, or, you know, whatever actually is going on. And we don't do that. It took 2 years. So Trump did not actually close the U.S. embassy in Cuba that Obama had reopened. But he did, because of the, you know, the whole Havana syndrome thing, you're familiar with that, dramatically curtailed and closed down all the visa and consular activities as soon as he came to power, under this absurd claim that there was some kind of energy weapon that the Cubans were using that has now been completely debunked. It took 2 years. It took until January of 2023, Biden rounding the two-year period, to partially restore the visa and consular services at the Cuban embassy, at the U.S. embassy in Cuba, that Trump had broken down. And I just don't understand. Like, he really must think that he's going to win Florida or something, because it's just so sad. But I do have hopes that if we have a Democratic president in 2025, they would be smart enough to actually make progress here, because the entire Chinese problem in Cuba is entirely about the United States not letting Cuba live, basically interact with us. And also, like, and I think there are a lot of more left-leaning people who hate this, but goddamn, like, if we drop that embargo, like, the Cuban government as it currently exists would last, like, 5-10 years. I think there's too many people in the United States who are hoping for a violent revolution in Cuba. I don't think there'd have to be a violent revolution. I think that simply furthering the policies they've already put in place. Raul Castro did a bunch of liberalization and, like, allowing people to own small businesses, that, like, or maybe no, maybe he, maybe that's the current guy who did that. So Fidel was succeeded by his brother Raul, who was also in his 80s and is still alive, but has now ceded power to some guy who was born after the Cuban Revolution, I believe. But successively, they're making more and more tourism focused, business focused, yeah, allowances, and allowing
roughly 10% of the economy at the moment, which also was massively hit by COVID.
Yeah. But they're already turning capitalist. And if we lifted the embargo and let US business folks get in there, it would be like China. It would be officially a, you know, revolutionary communist state.
Communist with capitalist tendencies. What's the
exactly
term?
Communism with Chinese characteristics. It would be communism with United States characteristics, frankly.
They could be social democrat, go Norway.
Sure. And I think that there's actually a surprising amount of leftist people who are kind of hurt, you know, horrified by that prospect. You know, the whole point was to be independent of the United States, but Cuba will never
be. You can't be when you're within sight of America.
Yeah, it's just not. It's not gonna.
And it's the superpower.
It's just not going to happen. And I do think it is entirely possible for Cuba to retain the incredible positive aspects. You know, their free healthcare, their the much higher level of equality that has been attained.
Literacy as well.
And it's also, it's kind of exciting to see. I mean, like, it seems like a lot of the Republican Party is acting like it's 1952, and the Soviet legions are about to parachute into Kentucky or something. The worldwide communist revolution failed. And I think it'd actually be really interesting to see how this revolutionary government that has made real social progress interacted with the capital, and maybe they found like a new kind of version, like a new kind of Norway, like a new kind of actual. And I think the power and the vigor and the commitment that these folks have to their revolution, like maybe they could be like a sort of Latin American Scandinavia that would have like a lot of amazing lessons to teach everybody.
And a positive effect on the Caribbean.
The world, Rory. Like a lot of like positive things to teach the world. God knows the United States could use a few lessons. I don't think we need to be terrified of this communist bacteria anymore. It's just absurd. Like, do these people even know what communism or socialism is or was? Like, it's just like this boogeyman word that people use. Yeah. I don't think we should be afraid of what the interaction of American capitalism and the Cuban Revolution would be. I think it could possibly produce something glorious. And I think too many people in the United States, both in Cuban refugee communities and the broader military industrial complex, are still so excited, salivating at the idea of a violent revolution or a violent invasion of Cuba. And we don't need to do that. We just need to drop the embargo and it'll be
naturally prosper.
Infinitely more friendly than Vietnam within a decade. And Vietnam's pretty friendly to the United States now. We just need, you know what? It's fine. We can just say, we lost. That's great. Well done. We're impressed. Let's get to business. And we can give China its own Taiwan off of our border.
It's also the fact that it seems that this isn't true. These bases aren't true, but you might just give China an idea.
That's absolutely it. No, so I actually don't doubt. I think that the Wall Street Journal and whatever military industrial complex folks are collaborating to put out these stories. I think the timing is very suspect. I think the timing is malicious and meant to sabotage diplomacy between the US and China. But I actually don't doubt for a second that China has a spy station. The Biden administration confirmed that China has a spy station.
But I mean, they don't have soldiers and they're not training Cubans or anything.
Well, so that's today's, June 20th, the Wall Street Journal has a story out saying that, but I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't. If you, you know, were given that whiplash that the Cuban government has been given from 2015 until 2023, like, you know, in 2015, you take us off the terror list, you open the embassies, the president comes here, the first president to go to Cuba since Calvin Coolidge in the 1920s. Give speeches, just this, that, and the other thing. This is good. We're working on it. And you get that whiplash of then Trump for 4 years, and then the vice president of the hero president who wanted to be your friend comes in and does nothing and leaves you on the terrorist list. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at all if Cubans are talking to China about, and the appropriate response to the Cubans talking to China about a military training facility is to drop the effing embargo, to take them off the terror list, to let American capitalism get in there and do American capitalism stuff. Really hope we do that. I'm terrified that we won't. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, let's hope America does. And
yes.
American-Cuban relations improve in the next coming years.
That'd be nice. And I think it's very possible, right? Like, say, this will be the second episode we end in on like optimistic possibilities. I do think it's very possible, and I would hope.
But a lot hinges on a second term for the Democrats.
Yes, a lot hinges on that because I think who knows, whatever Republican, possibly Donald Trump, that came into power could surprise, but I doubt it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we'll catch you next time on the More Freedom Foundation podcast.
The More Freedom Foundation is also available on YouTube, and TikTok. Rob's Twitter is RoboLaw, and he's also written a book called Avoiding the British Empire, What It Was and How the US Can Do Better. And music provided by Kevin MacLeod.